You must unite what has been set asunder.
We are TFR. Truth Frequency Radio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Covert Report with Susan Lindauer. Skype was doing one of its periodic updates, which is always a nuisance, and I have a wonderful guest today, Tony Gosling from London. And we are going to be talking about the European Union and the vote, the British vote to withdraw from the European Union and what the potentially ominous consequences of that are. Not that any of us are particularly enamored of the European Union and what it represents because of all of the problems that it has created for the member countries, but disentangling from this behemoth is going to be a kind of a scary thing and result in some it will definitely result in some global chaos. So, Tony, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Susan. Well, yeah, I mean, I've been, I suppose, following the history of the EU and the backstory, really, not the story, of how it was created, what it's all about, really since the mid-1990s when I first came across the very first lists of the Bilderberger conferences and published them on the internet. In 1996, I think I'm right in saying I was the first person in the world to do that. And I just put a few pages up. The Bilderberg participant lists from 1995 and 1996, just on a few pages with the official press release, which in the old days used to say in big black letters across the top, not for publication, press release. So you can imagine what kind of press release you send out, which is not for publication. And that's the way they operated in those days. The wire services knew about them. The big newspapers and the big newspaper owners, the big newspaper editors, the media empires, their bosses knew about the Bilderberg, but they certainly weren't telling their viewers, their listeners, or their readers. And the Bilderberg conferences, which brought together royalty with the oil companies and with big multinationals, big media companies, with a smattering of politicians, Also, pretty much any large industrial concern, things like car makers, Fiats, people like that, all together to get them on board the program, saying really effectively, look, we want a Europe which is going to work for big business, manufacturing, big companies, and not really for ordinary people, for small businesses. And that's what we've seen unfolding over the years. So this vote we're having in a few weeks' time here in Britain is really the first time we've had a proper election for 30 years or so since we joined the European Union in 1973.
So they forced you into this. They just made the decision that it was going to be done and it was going to happen. And then the next thing you know, the people are dragged into it.
Well, look, what happened in the 1970s is Britain signed in. This is Edward Heath, the Conservative Prime Minister, who many people may have known has now been implicated in these child sexual abuse, underage boys sex scandal, which, of course, may well be to do with him being bribed or blackmailed into signing these documents in 1973. But in 75, under a Labour government, there was a change of heart, and there was a referendum as to whether to join the EEC, the European Economic Community. And that was positive. That was affirmed by the British people at the time. And so that's the essential history of it, is we were told we're getting into a trade organisation, which is going to make it easier to trade in the 1970s. But that has slowly changed through things like the Maastricht Treaty, which, by the way, Margaret Thatcher refused to sign, and she was booted out. Because she refused to sign it, and John Major took over from her in around about 1980.
What was that treaty's going to do?
The Maastricht Treaty was really the beginning of the formation of the European Union, which was formally started in 1992. So this thing called the Trade Agreement Organization, the EEC, which Britain joined in the 1970s, in 1973, became the EEC, became the European Union. It became a political union under Maastricht, and nobody was ever asked about it. So we've now got the chance to say, no, we don't want anything more to do with this.
And even Maggie Thatcher refused to sign it. And well, she is free trade as they come.
She's famously quoted as saying, "I refuse to hand over this sovereign nation to 13 unelected bankers." And at which point there was a challenge to her leadership by Michael Heseltine, who was a leading Conservative. And eventually she was famously removed from Downing Street by the Conservative Party. I mean, it's quite clear.
Because she said she refused to hand over sovereignty of the country to 13 unelected bankers.
That's right, exactly. You can look that quote up online. And that was, I think, Margaret Thatcher did a lot of terrible things here in Britain, selling off much of our infrastructure, basically things like the state-owned, state-run water systems, electricity. So all the basic infrastructure of the country was run by the state, actually very well. It was run at cost, you know, effectively, so that when you paid for electricity, you weren't paying a load of shareholders and fat cat electricity bosses. You were paying just what it cost to supply you with electricity, and also the books of these nationalised industries were completely open to the public. They were, it was every penny that was spent, pretty much you could see where it had gone. Of course, when it's privatised, it all goes into commercial confidentiality, and Margaret Thatcher was responsible for selling off a lot of our family silver to private interests around the world. But when it came to the European Union, she absolutely put her foot down. She said, "We're going to have nothing to do with this political union," at which point she was elbowed out in 1990.
Wow.
Must get my timing right.
Get your timing right.
Yeah, it was 1990. Yeah,
and
so
she nailed it. I mean, she did a lot of terrible things. I remember I was there in the 80s and they used to have broadcast the unemployment figures in a big billboard across the Thames River.
That's right.
Yeah, and it was scary numbers, millions of people out of work.
Well, it was beautiful, actually. If you drove across Westminster Bridge, you'd be driving from Margaret Thatcher's Tory Westminster Palace over to Ken Livingstone and the Labour Party's County Hall, which was running London. So you had the Labour Party running London, but the Tories running the country on each side of the bridge. And they were kind of almost, you can imagine the officials kind of staring across the bridge at the other side of the political spectrum. Now, I mean, the European Union, and I think since I found out a lot more about it, there were basically cover stories. Intelligence parlance would call them cover stories put out about who formed the EU. For example, Jean Monnet, who was supposed to be kind of London-based during the Second World War, French guy that helped put it all together. Well, he was just a kind of name that got tagged onto it. This was an economic union, basically getting rid of all sorts of barriers to capital. So when they talk about trade barriers, I think it's much better to see them more as we can come and buy you up if we want to. That is to say, money is going to come in, foreign money, buy up your industries, take them over, so that what happens is your workers, well, we decide from abroad whether or not your workers are going to have a job or not, and all the money that they're making for us. That money isn't going to stay in your country, it's going to be sucked out. And I think that's fair to say that's what's been going on right across the European Union since the 1980s and certainly the 90s and the noughties. Our industry in Britain has been sucked dry by the EU. Many of the corporations, for example, people that make our trains here in Britain now is owned by Bombardier, a French firm. You know, foreign ownership is normal here. Most of the big heavy industry that we had here in Britain is now owned by abroad. It's difficult to find anything, particularly in the manufacturing world. I mean, if you want to you want to go into one of these great bankster monolithic tower blocks, the giant skyscrapers, you can find some of them are British, but they're certainly, their eyes are abroad. They're always threatening to leave Britain and saying, well, we're going to go. I mean, I don't think that there is very much that Britain is actually genuinely making economically, manufacturing anymore. Very, very little. Some luxury goods for the domestic, you know, sort of British market, the kind of remnant of nostalgic patriots that like buying British, you know, there's a little bit of that, but not much else, Susan.
And then the rest of it, like, for example, the French, the building the trains would be a big business in Britain. That would be a large market because of the the extraordinary network of rail lines. But if you're taking all the profits out.
Yeah, but look, the reason I mention that is because Britain invented the railways, and of course they built their empire. You know, I'm not a big fan of the British Empire. But
my great-great-grandfather built the railroad from Bombay to Calcutta. He was the engineer who designed and oversaw the construction by Indian coolies. And he also built the railroad in northern Scotland. Throughout Scotland, Northern England. Yes.
Well, our engineer forebears, I mean, actually, funnily enough, we've got people in our family who are involved in railway building in India. But, yeah, so maybe we're related and we never even knew it, Susan. Who knows? It was a small world. But the point really being that railways were a massive industry here. I mean, enormous industry. Now there are no British trains made. The same with cars. You know, think of things like the Daimler, the Rolls-Royce. Actually, Daimler, I think, was German. But the Rolls-Royce, you know, the great British marks of cars, none of those made. I mean, we had also, of course, the Bristol Aircraft Company. We've had airliners, whatever, the Concorde built in Britain. And yet, nothing. There's not a single aircraft being built here in Britain anymore. So I just look at the way that trade and manufacturing has gone in Britain, and I can see where it's gone. It's gone abroad, and the manufacturing industries that are competing with other countries, for example Germany and France within the EU, have been bought up and closed down. Now, you know as well as I do, this is the gangster capitalist monopolist's dream. If they can buy up the competition and close it down, then suddenly they can double their prices and everyone has to pay. They don't have any choice.
Yes, and that's what they're doing. They go into these areas and they buy them. It's what they've talked about doing in Ukraine. The one thing that they were so adamant about, trying to force the Ukrainians into the European Union, and the East versus the West, the Western Ukrainians wanting to have travel visas throughout Europe, and the Eastern Ukrainians saying, are you nuts? They're going to close us down. They're trying to make us adhere to their economic standards and their economic production requirements, and changing our production requirements to their production requirements is cost prohibitive, and all they're going to do is just buy us up and shut us down, and then we won't have any jobs at all.
Well, that's
except for the minerals and the low cost, you know, extraction of the resources that are used in production somewhere else.
Well, look, I mean, that's what's happening. But Britain is going into, I think, for the most part, a kind of almost a third world style economy. I mean, people have got money, but mostly it's older people who've got homes. Now, look, there's this whole myth of economic growth. They're talking about tiny figures, 0.5%, things like this, 0.3% growth. But you know where that growth is coming from? It's not coming from any kind of real extended output or increases in output or productivity or anything like that. It's coming from house price inflation. So what they're doing is there's this little silly little economic trick which they've worked out. If we can keep house prices going up, which they are doing, it makes it look as if the economy is being successful, because of all the there's a vast amount of money changes hands in terms of house transactions every year, and so they can count that as economic growth. The other thing they've done, Susan, which is, I think, absolutely despicable, is to include organised crime, that is to say prostitution and narco trafficking, as part of the quantities involved when they're working out what the growth figures are. So they desperately don't want to admit that growth is negative, and they're using all sorts of tricks. Now we've got, you know, several tricks going on in order to cover it up. There is absolutely no facing the economic reality that the massive debts that both has been mounted up right across Europe and in the United States and in other parts of the world, but particularly the transatlantic countries, are never going to be paid off. I mean, these debts are mounting up daily, and what with the 2008 bailout, we're now are running around a national debt of about 1.5 trillion. And anybody with any honest bone in their body will say that is never going to be paid off. At some point, this bubble's going to burst and there's going to be an almighty crash, possibly sooner rather than later. So it's almost like we're on a kind of economic cliff edge, and it wouldn't take much. All it would take would be some kind of international incident, maybe to do with the oil industry, the threatening the supply of oil, and the whole lot would come right down the cliff face and crash onto the rocks below. That is the economy.
That's it. The whole economy is on a cliff. That's what I keep saying. We're and it's true. We're really in a lot more trouble, and it's a global problem. But now coming, let's tie that back to the European Union, because that is one of the triggers that could – I mean, it's ironic because it's not a healthy functioning organization. It's actually technocratic. It's fiefdoms. It's – we saw what Angela Merkel did with refugees. You know, demand one nation, you know, Germany has managed. I mean, let's talk about this. The European Union was supposed to be a check on Germany, and yet Germany has now taken over the European Union and is now forcing all of Europe to bend to Germany's will.
Well, that's true. I think it's mainly because Germany has got so much clout. I mean, just as one example, when the European Central Bank was first created,
there was a lot of two world wars to stop that from happening.
Well, yes, but it may happen again. Yeah, so let's just be aware of that. When the European Central Bank was first created, Britain was under a lot of pressure to be involved in that, saying, "Well, look, unless you're part of the euro, the City of London is not going to have a say." So there was a big pressure from within the city and within the establishment elite in London to join the euro. Well, everyone's now looking at it, saying, "Thank God we didn't." You know, look what's happened to the rest of Europe. But when it was created, there was an agreement between the French and the Germans because they could not agree as to who was going to be the first president of the European Central Bank. And so there was an agreement to share the first term, I think it was 3 years or something, of the head of the central bank. Apparently the Germans managed to say, "Well, look, we want to be the heads of the central bank. We want to nominate the head of the central bank for the first year and a half, and then the French can do so for the remaining period, the second year and a half of the first term. You can nominate someone for that time." Well, you know what happened? After a year and a half, the French said, "Right, it's our turn now. We've got someone we want to be in charge." And the Germans said, "What? No, you can't. We're not going to move out of the office. We're still in charge." Yeah, so
you know, Germans refused to go.
They refused to go. So
they just said, "We're not leaving. It's too bad."
Oh, exactly.
This is ironic. This is like what Hitler wanted and what the Weimar Republic wanted in World War One and World War Two. And it's like this obsession with the Germans trying to get power over everybody else and dominate Europe. Lord.
It's an obsession with power, really. And I think you've got people who are, should we say, militantly secularist. That is to say, they don't really have moral values at all. They probably don't believe in God or anything like that. But they do believe in themselves, and they do believe in their own control of wealth. And what they've been doing, of course, through the power of the European Union, is they've been framing a whole legal system based around corporate power. That is to say, who is the strongest, the biggest, most powerful corporations are in the best position to decide what the regulations should be. So this is effectively how the EU works. Now, there is this kind of illusion that there is some democracy involved, because we have this ritual where we elect members of the European Parliament every few years here in Britain, the irony being that at least half of those MEPs elected are only sent to Brussels in order to try and close the whole thing down and stop it as a protest vote. So you've got these members of the European Parliament, but they have no power, Susan, at all. They can't suggest or propose laws. They can't make a proposal. They can't even do that. Those proposals all come from something called the European Roundtable of Industrialists. And here's the rub.
They really are bankers.
Well, not all bankers. No.
The European Roundtable of Industrialists, that's a banker group.
Yeah, but it is largely bankers. You're absolutely right. But there are also big, heavy industries involved, like steelmaking, Philips Electronics, Siemens, people like that. But anyway, so they basically just sit around and they say, well, we want things to be like this. Say, for example, when it comes to the regulation of, I don't know, some basic electronic device like digital radio, they will sit down and they'll say, well, this is what we want. And these are the people that are making these radios, making the electronics and things. And they say, well, this is what we're going to do. So Siemens, for example, which is, of course, a former Nazi company, will simply desktop publish and produce a document saying this is the future for digital radio in Europe. And then when the European Commission get it, they just take out the Siemens logo on the front and put a European Union, European Commission logo on. So all they're doing is changing the logo, and then that goes through as the new law. So that's how law is made in Europe. And the other thing to note is that these companies, I mean, I mentioned a couple of European, you know, Philips and Siemens there. They're not just European companies anymore, because, of course, you've got a big transatlantic corporate elite. Many of these companies are just as big in the United States as they are in Europe. And so when you're thinking about, well, maybe the EU and maybe this 500 million people continent is somehow independent of the United States, they're not, because the European Roundtable of Industries includes very powerful contingencies, which are mainly US companies too. So it's not just European companies that are making these decisions even. You've got this kind of illusion, I think, really, between the US of A and the US of Europe, which is that they're somehow different. I just see them really as a kind of good cop, bad cop on the world stage, that you've got the United States of America, you know,
being generous.
You know, gung-ho in places like, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, with the Brits on their coattails. You know, obviously, you know, historically, places like Vietnam, absolutely devastated. But and in South America right now, you know, lots and lots of covert operations being conducted by the Americans, very cloak and dagger, you know, millions of people affected, you know, probably tens of thousands, very bad, you know, many deaths, of course, as well. And the Europeans try and come across with Angela Merkel as the kind of more reasonable approach. Actually, it's just two hands, in two different fists. One is just a little bit softer than the other, but they're both working together, doing the same work. The idea being, you try and get the confidence of people through the reasonable Europeans, and meanwhile, the Americans are kind of doing the same work from the other direction as a kind of direct military force, as the Europeans are conducting a more diplomatic approach. But they're both effectively the same. And of course, Europe is much bigger. You've got about 320 million. In the United States of America, the United States of Europe is 500 million people. So it's a much bigger power block.
It's a much bigger power block, but it's not running very well.
No.
we're about to go to the break, so I want you to sum this part of it up. But then I want to come back to who is really running, what is the power base in Europe about the European Parliament and how sovereignty is affected by this, because we're losing. There's potentially a global meltdown coming, and nobody seems to have the power to stop it. I mean, really and truly, if the European Union, I mean, I'm interested in whether or not if the European Union falls, what is that going to mean for the rest of us?
Uncensored talk and news you won't hear in the mainstream media 24 hours a day. Truth Frequency Radio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Covert Report with Susan Lindauer and my great guest today, Tony Gosling, who is a true expert on the European Union. You are exactly the person to explain this issue to us. And I am so glad to have you, Tony. What you're saying, though, I'm interested in, given that the Council on Industrial Development versus the European Parliament, and you every year, you know, we hear about these elections, the European elections, and there's so many players trying to get out of the European Union, and they're campaigning like we're gonna pull our country out, we're gonna cut back on the power that we are ceding to Europe. Are they, what is the European Parliament now? If they're not making laws, if they don't have any power, I mean...
Well, there's a lot of people asking exactly that question in the back of their minds, Susan. Unfortunately, zero London journalists seem to be asking that question, which is, you know, it's one of the most important questions you can ask. What is it for? Well, of course, the main thing it's for is window dressing. These members of the European Parliament get paid a vast amount. They live in a kind of cocoon in Brussels, which is its own world. So there can be riots, machine gun fire, raging around the building, but they're in their tranquil kind of shopping centre, which it is a shopping centre, sealed off from the rest of the world in their little cocoon. So that's what the MEPs actually experience, vast amounts of money to spend, unaudited, of course, because for the last 20 years, the European Union's accounts have never been signed off by auditors. No one really knows where this money has gone. It's basically a little kind of a gangster's dream. No one is ever going to check where you spend the money on or where or why. But the main thing it's for is a kind of window dressing experience for the public. So they think that there's something kind of democratic going on. Yes, it's over, it's abroad, it's over in Brussels, it's far away from England. But the fact of the matter is there's no real ability for these people to change laws, make laws. All they can do is really slow them down. And that's what happens there. You know, if there's a proposal, the MEPs all vote against it, it will come along the next week with some kind of little change to it, and then they'll have to vote all against that again. And there's people, you know, the MEPs, even if they have managed to get together the enthusiasm to wade through a 10-foot-high stack of papers around a particularly new bit of legislation to try and understand it, they just get argued down, and this stuff just goes through. There's a lot of pressure on these MEPs, basically, not even to turn up, because they still get paid if they don't turn up. It's an absolute window dressing farce, and there is no real democracy in it whatsoever. It's actually a complete aberration. But look, the main thing to do, I think, in any of these sorts of situations is to look at what has been the result. What has it produced, the European Union? And the answer to that is, in the last 10 years or so, we've had two major continental crises. The first one being the economic crisis of 2008, where there was complete failure of any regulation of the banking system through the European Union. Incidentally, the world banking system is mostly regulated out of Basel in Switzerland, the Bank for International Settlements, which is not in the EU. But most of the European EU banks are obviously part of the European Union. So there's two stages to this. So you've got the Swiss doing most of the regulation, and then most of the actual banking itself and a small amount of the regulation being done by the European Union. You know what, Susan? They totally failed to do anything, because what they did is, after the 2008 crisis, the bailout, where the public took on all the debts that the bankers should have taken on, a whole bunch of bankers were brought in to decide what to do by the EU. And of course, they decided to do virtually nothing at all. So we're now in exactly the same situation as we were in 2008, with crooked accounts being rolled out year after year for the major banks on the continent and in the US as well, I believe. It's probably true to say, and also a great deal of pressure on these banks to, by governments particularly, to extend loans to people that can't pay them back, for example, through things like house price. You know, you remember the subprime mortgage scandal, which is one of the things that led to the 2008 crash. Well, they're doing exactly the same now by saying, well, look, these people can't afford to buy houses at the prices that they are in a moment in Britain. We're talking about average house prices, something like £800,000 in London. In Bristol, where I live, £300,000 for one basic house. The people cannot afford to buy these. So there's pressure on the banks.
No one can afford to buy these things. It's not very, very few people. This is what you were saying before. They've been manipulating house prices to make it look like there's economic growth and to substitute for real production value in manufacturing and such, and service industries, and there's nothing except these housing prices. But then without employment figures with high income, you're not able to pay these things.
Well, look, you're coming along to the second crisis, which is the migrant crisis, and it's not really a refugee crisis. There's far fewer refugees than there have been migrants, and one of the main conduits has been through Libya, of course, which was disgustingly smashed to pieces by the NATO alliance a few years ago, and Gaddafi executed, who, when he did his coup back in the 1950s or 60s, it was a bloodless coup. He just said, well, everyone that doesn't want to be around, the former King Idris, can just get on a plane and leave, and we're not going to do anything to you. So they did. But look, the migrant crisis has been what this is all about, Susan, really, which is to drive down wages. And this has had a massive effect on ordinary Brits, even people who are migrants who came over from the West Indies, for example, and from India in the 1960s, are starting to bang their fists on the table and say, we've had enough immigration in Britain, because now you've got people over here who aren't even entitled to be here. But what they're doing is they're driving away. They're prepared to work for next to nothing because they're living in slum conditions. Some of them are living in tents, you know, this kind of thing. And they're prepared to work for anything. So this is an absolute joy for the big corporations, in that they can now employ people for virtually nothing. Yes, they have to pay for skilled labour, but then they've got a much wider area that they can bring that skilled labour in from. And so a lot of the British people who've got that skilled labour have been taken out of jobs to bring in people who are prepared to accept less. It's had a massive effect on driving down wages, so it's hardly surprising that people can't afford to buy houses. So what's happened is the mortgage companies are now starting to do the whole subprime thing again, with help from the government. So they've got this thing called the Help to Buy scheme, which is really about help to sell houses, where we're going into subprime zone again. So there just seems to be a complete inability, either of the mainstream London journalists. I mean, there are one or two, like Ian Fraser at the Scottish Herald in Glasgow, who does really talk the talk. But people like him are few and far between. Most of the London journalists are so close to the city that they're supposed to be reporting on that they just simply write whatever they want them to write. And there's no real proper critical. And the other thing, of course, is in the field of economics, in the economic profession, you would have thought that all these people who have been trained up to understand the way the economy works, would be banging their fists on the table saying, what on earth have you done? You brought us to a cliff edge. And we're never going to pay off the national debt. This is a total disaster. But of course, they want to keep their jobs. And also there's an economics orthodoxy which goes against that. There are one or two, like Professor Steve Keen from Kingston University in Surrey, who has written a great book called Debunking Economics, who's saying, like you and I are, this is a total disaster, and what we need is a total revolution in the way we understand economics. Because I don't know if you know this, Susan, but in economics degrees, that sort of level of the teaching of the subject, there is this total misnomer that the banking sector and the financial sector has a neutral influence on the way the economy works. Can you
believe that? Yes, I remember that. I was like, the banking sector doesn't have an impact on this? It's benign. It's benign. They're just watching from the sidelines and just receiving whatever. Oh, no. Yeah, that's right.
It's a total load of rubbish.
It's really shocking. It's like,
they have a tremendous influence. You know what their main influence is? Who they lend to and who they don't. You know, this is a massive, massive influence. You know, they will find certain types of industries, certain individuals who they will lend almost infinite amounts of money to, and then others, small businesses, for example, they'll lend them a bit, and then they'll call the loan in when they know the person is going through a bit of a difficulty,
or smash the business to pieces. The farmers who, you know, during the Great Depression of the United States, people needed food so badly. And so what they did was they drove up the food prices. They grabbed up all the land that they could for agribusiness in the United States anyway. And they shut down all the small farms. And it would have been salvation for everyone. But they saw an opportunity to grab the land and they took it.
Well, that's the sort of thing they've been doing here, particularly, you're right, with the farming sector as well. Extending loans to farmers, and then when they're going through a difficult time, they can contact the bank and say, you know, we may have to not be able to repay this loan for a few months. The bank then says, oh dear, they just completely foreclose on the loan. But then, of course, the other thing that the banks do is, say, for example, you and I, Susan, I know we would never do it. We set up a genetic engineering company looking at genetically engineered crops. The banks will lend us vast amounts, millions, even billions of pounds of money that they've made up at the press of a button, and we can go off and have some fun and try and make a kind of Terminator seed or something. And then we come back to the banks in 2 or 3 years' time. We say, oh, we're really sorry. We spent all that money, but we didn't get anywhere. We need a little bit more, but, you know, it's all gone. And the banks go, oh, okay, they just write it off. And they say, here's a bit more. Try again. So their banks have a fantastic amount of discretion. A little bit like, you know, a little bit like the police. So the police have a lot of discretion into which crimes they investigate and which they don't. Say, for example, the crimes, war crimes of Tony Blair versus the crime of a young kid who's got nothing at all, stealing a bottle of water from a shop in East London, you know. So what happens with the banks is that they have their own agenda for the way they want the world to develop, towards a privatization agenda, towards when I talk about the genetic side of things, this is about trying to own genetic material, which is given as a free gift to mankind. They want to control that, they want to own that, and they want to make sure that all farmers of the world go back to them every time they need a seed to plant a crop. So this is a totally wicked technology, and it's about control, and the banks have a fantastic amount of it. And this is why I actually think of the banking system around the world rather like a cult. It's like, you know, it's so wicked, the stuff that goes on in there. And this is one of the reasons I think we've seen a lot of death of bankers over the last 2 or 3 years, is once people find out the depth of the evil that's going on, that often that they start to say, well, I'm going to have to tell people about this, I'm going to have to blow the whistle. They find that they don't get a chance to do that, because the power that these bankers have, and also the obsession, and the it's almost like an addiction to this infinite amount of wealth that they've got, is fed by seeing more and more people around them in poverty and more people beholden to them. So they're almost like, I would almost say they're like the new gods of the world. They think of themselves like that anyway. You know, basically everything we want to fund, we will fund, and anything that we don't smile kindly on, it's going to wither and die. And this is the way these bankers think, and they're now basically owning and controlling most of our political parties, and much of our media too. So those are basically the only two defenses that we as ordinary citizens have got against tyranny, are those two factors. That's parliamentary democracy, or, you know, honest democratic leaders investigating things like the Church Committee, you know, these kind of wonderful institutions that have done this over the years, investigating the excesses of big business and sometimes intelligence services. But also hard-hitting investigative journalism that shocks the nation. You know, we're seeing so much less of that because those with the wealth and power are slowly buying it up, Susan.
Well, that is a major problem, that they are targeting people. I am fighting a battle with my mortgage company right now, and so it's a lot on my mind. And my house, I bought my house at the bottom of the market, and it now has grown over 15 years to have a huge amount of equity in it. Now, the only way to cash out the equity is to sell the house. So what they've tried to do is to try to figure out how they can take my house and force me out of it so that they could seize the equity in it. And that's what's going to happen more and more to the older population. I am not a senior, people, but senior citizens, older people who have accumulated wealth through their own homes are going to see that their houses are ripped off as well, because that's the only, what they're doing is they're gobbling up whatever wealth is, whatever sign of wealth there is, whatever it has been accumulated anywhere or saved by anybody. They have to, they're like debt junkies, and they are greed junkies or something.
Yeah, but the reason they focus on houses is very, very simple. I mean, this is why what makes me think that we are really are heading for an almighty crash. And of course, we didn't. You know, people talk about 2008 as a crash. It wasn't. It was a bailout to avoid a crash. And what this is what makes me think we may be heading to one now with this enormous housing bubble we've got here in the UK. I'm not really sure about this, what the situation. I know it's fairly similar in the US. It's because the house is the one thing we need the most. We spend most of our money on, generally, if we're middle income or low income, through our whole lives, and it's the one thing we most need. So that is the one thing that the financial services industry knows that they can screw the price up the highest, you know, than anything else. I mean, this is one of the other reasons, of course, where we've had a migrant crisis, massive immigration, 300,000 people a year now coming into Britain, is because that helps to kick up the house prices and massively increase the demand for housing. That's why they focus on the homes and the houses, is because it's the thing we need the most and we have most invested in. Everyone needs it. I think it's Article 25 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is the right to shelter. Everybody should have it on this planet. There is no reason why our governments shouldn't deliver a decent roof over every single person's head.
Also frightening is the catastrophic desire to destroy the middle classes of all of our societies, Europe, Britain, America. They're out to wipe us out. They really are. Right. Anything we have is something that they could take. And that's how they regard it. We're in the way of themselves accumulating more wealth to pay their crazy debt schemes.
But I think as well, they're trying to force people. It's not just that they want more wealth, because they've already got more than they could ever spend in 100 lifetimes. You know, a lot of these 0.001% people just don't need more wealth. They just need to impoverish the rest of us in order to get power over us, to really stop people having the time to get politically active, for example. A best way to do that is to get people into debt. Then they have to start running around earning money the whole time. They've got no time to devote to exercising their democratic rights and campaigning, you know, taking part in activities of NGOs, starting new NGOs, this kind of thing. The idea really is to rob us of our time. You know, that's why they're trying to drive as many people as possible into debt. So I don't think it's just their own greed. They're also seeing that they need to impoverish anybody that might stand against them. I think it's also when it comes to the European Union, you know, this is what we're ostensibly focusing on today, is we've got a lot of evidence now. It's starting to really accumulate, although not at all being discussed in the London media, that there was a great deal of US influence in the creation of the EU, which might not surprise you, Susan, because at the end of the Second World War, there was a lot of worry in the US, particularly the newly formed CIA, Alan Dulles and his people, that there were European countries that might start embracing the Soviet Union and becoming very friendly with the communists. As you know, Yugoslavia under Tito was a kind of independent communist country, but it wasn't actually communist. It was more sort of socialist communists. And they had a kind of workers' cooperatives running most factories, very successful factories in Yugoslavia in the 1950s and 1960s and 70s. And, for example, in those factories, if the workers started thinking that one of their bosses was a bit of an annoying guy or he wasn't up to the job, they could have a vote and get him sacked. There were workers' co-ops, were very successful in Yugoslavia, and that model was starting to be looked at many people, particularly in Eastern Europe, and saying, you know, that is to say, you know, the west of the Berlin Wall, they'd say, well, hang on a minute, this is really good. I mean, like, for example, particularly Italy, especially after the backlash, after the dictatorship, you know, during the Second World War, there was a real reaction against fascism and a more of an embracing of communism. So the EU was set up in order to try and control that swing to the left that was going on in Europe. And I know the CIA spent vast amounts of money in trying to fix elections, well, successfully fixing elections, also running the Red Brigades, the terrorists in Italy, who were made to look like the people they were behind things like the Bologna bombing in 1980.
Operation Gladio.
Yeah, and this was a vast effort, mainly out of the US, but with some British cooperation through groups like the SAS and Special Forces, British Special Forces, in order to swing Europe pro-America, make all eyes head westwards across the Atlantic to the US, and to really get on board this Cold War demonization of the Soviet Union. Now, I'm not saying, and you could talk to anyone who lived under the Eastern European bloc under the Soviets, that it was, you know, no bed of roses. But the ideas were powerful ideas that certain types of industry, particularly infrastructure, national infrastructure, should be run for the benefit of all at cost. And that then allows the country to fulfill its potential more. So you're not paying over the odds for train travel, for moving cargo around the country, for electricity, gas, for energy, for water, even things like telecommunications. You know, you're paying what it costs you. Then you can just get on with whatever you're good at and get on making money. And that was a very successful model, particularly in places like Yugoslavia and in other parts of the east of Europe. And the US really didn't want the countries, big countries like West Germany, France and Britain, Spain, etc., and Italy, starting to follow that model and really sticking two fingers up to the Americans.
That's right. It all has to be about profits. Yep.
Well, it's
let's bring it to back to the European Union, because there's something that China is entering the IMF. We're looking at a devaluation of the petrodollar. The United States currency is no longer, the U.S. dollar is no longer the major currency in the world. There, even Donald Trump is talking about going to the gold standard. What is going to happen with the European Union if the European Union collapses? And, well, you know, on one hand, what you're saying is, and I agree with you, I'm not disputing this. I think the European Union has been badly designed or needs to be totally reconstructed, totally rebuilt.
Susan, let me just interrupt you there, because when you say that it's been badly designed, I had a very good friend, Grattan Healy, who he used to work for Virginia McKenna, who was a Green Party member of the European Parliament. And he was an engineer, trained as an engineer, and he'd been working there for several years. And I met him at the Bilderberg conference back in 2000, I think it was. Around about that time. But Grattan said to me, he said, over a pint in a pub somewhere in Versailles, I think it was, outside the Bilderberg meeting. He said, look, the European Union was designed to never work. And I've had a good look at it as an engineer. It will never work. It will work for the big companies, but it will never work for ordinary people. And the longer it's there, the more wealth will be sucked out of individuals' pockets and more power put into the hands of banks and multinational corporations. And he said, I want no more part of it. And you know what? Three or four months after, he resigned, and he went on to do a business to do with ecological energy, like solar power and water power, over in Ireland. And he's been a very happy man ever since. When I saw him at the European Union, he was tearing his hair out.
So it's definitely not designed to work at all. Well, if the European Parliament, if the elected members of Parliament have already ceded their authority, the Industrial Development Council would not want to give up its power either. They see it as a zero-sum game.
Just to get this right, it's the European Roundtable of Industrialists. They're an official body. They've got a little office in Brussels. And you can even go and knock on their door if you want to. One of the documentaries I would definitely recommend, if anyone wants to really get their heads around what's going on with the Brussels European Union, is this film called The Brussels Business, which is really about lobbying and how the whole thing there. I mean, you say it doesn't work, and I would say it doesn't work, but it does work for some people. It works for the big corporations and it works for the banks, because their lobbyists have all the power. They have the access to the European Commission, And in this film, The Brussels Business, it really spells out how it all works. And so it is working for some people. It's just the actual machinations of it are quite hidden. I mean, I just getting back to what we were talking about, the formation of the European Union through US and US influence and US money. I'd just like to hand over now for 2 or 3 minutes, maybe before we have another break.
We're about to go to break right now.
Oh, are we? Maybe after that you can have a chat to Fran Scott. She's done a lot of work on this. I mean, she's one of our 9/11 crew here in Britain, done a lot of work on the anthrax attacks, things like that, and also on the 7/7 London bombings. But, you know, what we're doing is we're doing the investigative journalism. We're drilling down to find out how we got to where we are. It's much better to do that than to understand what's going on.
Everybody, will be right back.
The Covert Report with Susan Lindauer. No hate. No hype, no fear. We are TFR Frequency Radio.
And Fran Scott is going to join us now.
Hi there, Susan.
Hi there, Fran. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, right before the break, Tony was saying that you also have a lot of expertise on this. I'm very interested in what the year it see, the thing is, Britain is about, let me back up and remind everybody, the British people are about to vote on whether they should withdraw from the European Union. The European Union is in crisis right now. As we've heard, it has never been a highly well-functioning organization, but it has now reached a point with the refugee crisis, the migrant refugee crisis, and Angela Merkel having dunced everybody by throwing open the gates to Germany and then saying, well, no, she knows very well that when the migrants come in to Germany, they're going to have visa rights to travel all through Europe. So what she did was she made a unilateral decision for her own country that then forces all the other countries to adhere to German standards, knowing that that the people are not going to stay in Germany. They're going to travel all through Europe and they're going to try to get into Britain and they're going to. So there is now a crisis where the European Union might collapse. Now, the European Union in itself, as we have just described in the first hour, is a pretty wretched organization. It has deprived the sovereign nations of their own identity and capability to maneuver to protect their own heritage, to protect their own value system, to reflect the will of the people. Democracy and republican values have been shredded. It's gone. Europe is a previously feudal state. It has only responded to change through violent revolution, whether it's World War I, World War II, the Napoleon Wars. You go back and the French Revolution, it's always been bloody. Every time that there's an upheaval, it's a bloody upheaval and everything gets torn down. But now that we're in a modern day scenario where we have weapons that we've never seen, like that have never been used in any conflict like this before, and, you know, even something like the British doing something smart, like getting out of the European Union, is a smart thing to do. What's going to happen to the Eurozone? What's going to happen to the euro currency? And is this going to be a trigger that's going to be a meltdown for Europe? And if there is a European meltdown, which it really could happen, it really could be a meltdown, because there's going to have to be in order for transformation to come, there's got to be a deep upheaval to throw this thing out. And that in itself is revolutionary. So what do you guys think of, what are you thinking of what I'm saying here?
Well, yes, Susan, I think you're quite right, because the European Union has never been set up to be a democratic organisation from the word go. And, you know, for instance, we've got Philippa Gee, who was a CIA whistleblower, wrote a book in the late 1970s where he's got documentary evidence to show that the CIA deliberately financed pro-European Union organizations throughout Europe, particularly in Britain, in his book called The CIA in Western Europe. They funded a lot of the pro-European movement, for instance, the American Committee for the United Europe, which was just, they were just CIA fronts, basically. And the Labour Party used to be quite European sceptic, European Union sceptic, and up until about the 1980s, and the CIA funded a split-away party called the Social Democratic Party in order to split the left-wing vote, and that was very pro-European Union. And then we had the Blairites, the Tony Blair and his New Labour, which was a coup within the Labour Party, which was definitely pro-EU. So going back to Edward Heath's administration in the early 1970s, his cabinet met in 1971 to discuss Britain in the European Union.
And everybody, sorry, Edward Heath is now recognized to be a pedophile who is running the, seriously, this is not just outlandish talk. He was involved in pedophile rings in Europe, in London, and was bringing home little young teenage boys to his house and was being blackmailed, we think, by MI5 and the British government. They were protecting him, feeding him little boys, but then exacting prices for these policies. Okay, keep going, Fran.
That's the sort of way that the intelligence agencies tend to work, is to get politicians to compromise themselves sexually, and then they've got the evidence on them for their sexual misdeeds, and then, yes, they can blackmail them and say, you've got to be pro this or pro that. And anyway, getting back to Edward Heath's cabinet minutes in 1971, we, the British people, did not know what these cabinet minutes said, because as soon as they were written, they were slapped with a top secret notice not to be read for 30 years. So it wasn't until 30 years, that's what, 2001, that we could actually read what the cabinet minutes said. And it quite clearly said that they knew, Edward Heath and his ministers knew full well, that the European Union was not a union of trade interests. You know, the idea was to sell to the public that we had nothing to worry about. We're just going to be setting up a trading agreement between European countries to make it easier for us and easier to travel to Europe. That's all it was, when in actual fact, these cabinet minutes show they knew it was going to be a European superstate. They knew it was going to be the end of any sovereignty for any EU country that joins the EU. That's the end of their sovereignty. Their parliament is superseded by the European Commission. The European Commission is unelected, is undemocratic, is unaccountable to any European people whatsoever. And as Tony quite rightly pointed out, the European Roundtable of Industrialists are the biggest, most powerful lobby group that has so much influence on the EU Commission. The EU Commission practically goes along with what the European Roundtable of Industrialists wants. And the EU Parliament is toothless. It has no power to complain, to get rid of a bill that has drastic implications for the people of Europe. Basically, the European Union has its roots in the Nazis, as far as I'm concerned, which Tony will back me up because he's done a lot of research on that. It's been funded by the CIA and backed by the CIA, and we've got even President Obama saying we shouldn't leave the EU. Why is he saying that? Why is he so interested in us being in or out? And, you know, this indicates the interest of Americans' interest in the European Union. And basically, it's anti-democratic, and people should definitely vote to come out. I mean, look at the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, for instance, and the CETA, which is another unfair trade agreement. These are unfair trade agreements that have been agreed in secret with members of the European Roundtable of Industrialists and the EU Commission and some other top officials in America or Canada. And we weren't supposed to know about these unfair trade agreements. We only know because the documents were leaked to the public. Otherwise, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership may well have already got signed. And, you know, this is a direct attack on any form of democracy you can think of. It's a corporate takeover of democracy. And that's what the EU is all about. That's what people need to understand. Even if Jeremy Corbyn was prime minister tomorrow and he said that he's anti-austerity and he wants to do lots of anti-austerity policies, etc., the EU would not allow him to do it because EU directives clearly state that we have to liberalise, in inverted commas, that is, open our public services to private investment. So, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, he's mistaken if he thinks that he can reform the EU, because the EU is not something you can reform because it is rotten to the core. It has to be disbanded. And yes, it could cause a lot of disruption across Europe if that happens. But I think it's got to be done. Definitely, Susan. But I think it was inevitable anyway, because the euro is just does not work. I mean, to expect the so many different countries with slightly different economies to be able to have the same currency is just absolute madness. You know, so it's going to disintegrate from within. It's going to destroy itself from within. I just hope to God the British people are not listening to these fear-mongering from the pro-EU people saying if we come out of the EU, Britain is going to have an economic collapse. I mean, there's going to be an economic collapse anyway, whether we're in Europe or not in Europe. So what difference would it make? And there's plenty of countries that are European, but they're not in the EU, and they trade with the EU, and they're not suffering, so we can do the same.
Well, now that's very interesting, because in fact, if you stay in the EU and there's a collapse, you're not going to, Britain and the countries that are part of it will not have the capability to adjust their own policies to save their own people. They won't be able to, they won't have the authority to override what doesn't work.
Yeah,
so the only chance they've got to save themselves is if they do break out of the EU.
Well, let me chip in here for a minute, Susan, because if you look at the economics of it and the amount of growth we've had in the European Union countries has been going down and down and down ever since the 1950s and 1960s, before we were in the European Union. Britain was growing quite nicely. When we had the next decade from the next couple of decades from the mid 1970s to the mid 1990s, growth had gone down quite a lot. That was after we joined the European Union, and from the mid 90s to now, growth has gone through the floor. If you look at it as a comparison to economic growth, just the bald economic growth figures, even though, as I said before, these figures are right now being fixed, massively being fixed. So it's almost like you're in a kind of suicide block. So the obvious thing to do is get out of it. With the rest of the world, the growth in average countries in other parts of the world outside the European Union is going up and up all the time compared to the EU. So why on earth would you like to be in this kind of whirlpool of economic failure? It's a bit of a no-brainer. But the thing is that there's a massive amount of propaganda around in Britain at the moment in the run-up to this referendum. So, one of the things I always remind people is that the big media corporations with the millions of viewers, even though, of course, most of our young people raise their eyes to modern television, news, that kind of thing. They don't even bother watching it, most of them. And they get a lot of their news from the internet, from social media, that sort of thing. Well, they've been saying is, all of the possible disasters that there'll be if we leave the EU again and again. And I could not believe it last week, Susan. I think it was maybe Wednesday evening or Tuesday evening last week on the Channel 3 ITV news here in Britain, a national news bulletin. We had a big piece about how dangerous it would be if we left the European Union on the news again. And then they said, oh, well, we're just going to hear what the Brexit people have got to say about this. And you know what? The screen went blank for a few seconds, and then it went back to the student. They were shuffling their papers, and they said, oh, we seem to have some sort of technical error there. I'm not sure what they were going to say, and maybe they were going to say this, maybe we're going to say that, and then it just went to an ad break. So this is the sort of thing we're seeing. You're only getting one point of view. And if you could imagine, you've got the Brexit camp and the Remainers, they call them, is a wide spectrum. What we're getting is we're getting a very thin, gruel debate, which is mostly around the better arguments for staying in the EU and the worse arguments to get out. So the public are getting this impression that, well, actually the most important thing is that we just keep the status quo. Well, the status quo in the European Union means slow strangulation. Effectively, that's what we would be getting out of, which I think would be rather a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Go on, Fran.
Yeah, and I read a newspaper report in Britain recently that the EU is well aware that there's a lot of British people that are dissatisfied of the EU. I mean, all the opinion polls are saying that it's quite a close call with this vote. So what the EU are doing is they're not issuing some directives that they think might upset the British people until after the referendum. And then they're going to hit us with a load of really nasty directives. I don't know what they are exactly, but that's what I read in the papers. And I'm not surprised, because they just want to put a nice spin on the EU at the moment. And another thing I'd like to raise is the rise of the far right in Europe. I think it's been quite deliberate that using this... this no borders, where loads of people can move around Europe at will, and people's jobs have been at stake, and pressure on public services. It's encouraged the rise of the right. And in Britain in particular, all we hear is mostly the right-wing criticisms of the EU, when there's so many criticisms of the EU right across the political spectrum. So they make the, as Tony pointed out, they try and make the Brexit people look like they're some kind of raving xenophobes.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Well,
another thing is that you've got also two or three countries which are looking to, in Eastern Europe, which are looking to join the European Union. That's all been put on hold until after this vote, because they don't want that being discussed and circulated as part of the discussion, so they kept it completely quiet. Several Eastern European countries, including Ukraine, also we've now got Turkey wanting to join the EU as well, and the Germans starting to do deals with
so that the Turkish people, now check this out, once Turkey's in the EU, it automatically opens up all doors for immigration, free immigration without checks between Turkey and Europe. And that means that all those refugees who are in Turkey right now, they can just go straight in without any background checks. They just cross over the border and they can come right in, and no one can stop them.
So you know what? They're keeping that one very quiet. They don't want to talk about that at all. I think it's also absolutely fair to say, I mean, I've done a video online. It was actually an interview with Spanish Radio, Susan, and it went onto YouTube about a month ago, and it's just gone astronomical. It's actually got more hits now than any of the official campaigns, films, or else more hits also than the major London media's reports. It's called What the BBC Won't Tell You About Brexit, and it's really a look at the German industrial policy during and after the war, and why the European Union was really put together something with the same name anyway, the European Economic Community, which is what we joined in 1973. The Nazis in 1942 called it the Europäische Wirtschaft Gemeinschaft. It was something which was drawn up in Nazi Germany in Berlin. And that video has done very well. But what it really, in a nutshell, says and it explains is all based on the work of a guy called Paul Manning. He was a CBS news correspondent during World War II. And he was tracing a lot of the Nazis after the war over to South America, into Switzerland. His big task was to look at German industrial policy and also at the routes that the wealth had taken, and the individuals, specific individuals like Martin Bormann. And the title of the book is Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. I mean, there's been lots of attempts, several attempts after the Second World War, to make it look as if Bormann, who was Hitler's treasurer, Hitler's deputy, died at the end of the Second World War. But actually, he didn't. It's quite clear now that he did survive in South America. It looks like he possibly even came to Britain in between times. But all that work by Paul Manning, I mean, Manning was one of the voices who was best known to Americans from 1941 when the U.S. entered the war. Even before the U.S. entered the war, he was reporting from Britain on what had been going on in Europe. And right the way up until the end of the war in Europe, Manning was a voice that many Americans recognized as the authentic voice of the best reporting in the world on what had been happening in World War II. But he was absolutely clear about the German cartel system being what was rolled out right across occupied Europe, and that this was the system that the Nazis had designed, the Europäische Wirtschaft Gemeinschaft, as something which they wanted to see right across Europe. So that is, I think, one of the most interesting bits of hard evidence that what you're dealing with here is a kind of corporate takeover, a soft fascist takeover. So I'm not talking about, you know, the SS out on the streets, the Gestapo out on the streets arresting people, torturing people, but effectively a kind of a financial empire which is slowly sucking up the wealth of Europe into the hands of a tiny few people for their own private profit. So that did quite well, that video. And I think what we're dealing with today effectively is not overt Nazi tanks. It's the banks, the banking sector, which has taken over. I mean, you can take over with a bank by buying somebody up in a hostile takeover bid, take over their building, take over their industry, exactly as people used to do in World War II using tanks. It's just done in a less obviously aggressive way, but it's exactly as effective. You own that person, you own that building, you own those people, you own that industry. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing today in the European Union with this rollout. And there are literally hundreds of millions of people across Europe who are looking very, very closely at what Britain is doing in the next few weeks to see which way we vote, because there are two reasons why. One is because a lot of Europeans see the Brits as the Americans' cat's paw in the European Union, that we are a kind of Trojan horse for the Americans inside the middle of the EU. And they don't like the aggressive foreign policy that the Brits are up to all the time. So they quite like to see us go. But there are millions of other Europeans that also want somebody to end the nightmare, the torture. The Greeks have had a hell of a time under the EU banking system. Millions of Greeks thrown out of work. I think the most horrendous tragedy is the sort of 16 to 25 year olds right across southern Europe have been robbed of opportunities for a career. Millions and millions of them are out of work. Something like 20-25% of young people have just got no prospect of a job in southern Europe.
God. So
people are saying right across Europe, come on, Britain, you did it once or twice before. You've shown the Germans what you're good at.
Yeah.
Do it again.
Because this is what World War I and World War II were fought over, to stop Germany from doing exactly what they're doing right now.
Exactly, Susan. That's why the EU, as far as I'm concerned, and many people are concerned, is the Fourth Reich all over again. And if people think that's being anti-German, there's somebody called Horst Herbert, who is German himself, who has actually spoken about this on the EU counter summit that was held in London in October last year, which is available on the internet, Pax Vista TV YouTube channel. Horst Herbert from Germany, German person, actually talking about the Nazi roots of the EU and how Germany is the dominant force in the EU, and you know, so that's straight out of the horse's mouth for you.
Well, you know, I don't even care if it's anti-German. What Angela Merkel has done with the migrant crisis, creating a crisis that doesn't even exist. What you're saying, that there's 20 to 25% unemployment among young Europeans, okay? Young Europeans in the 18 to 30 range age group, okay? And there are plenty of workers who don't have jobs. We know this has been a problem in Spain and Portugal and Ireland and Italy and Greece. You can just go right across the European continent and see the damage, see these people who are anxiously waiting, looking for opportunity, who are on the dole, who are on unemployment. And then you have to, and then Angela Merkel is saying, oh, we've got a labor crisis. We have a shortage of labor. We have to bring in these migrants because otherwise there's nobody to do these jobs, except for the 20 to 25% unemployed young people who have been schooled and educated, who want the jobs. And you can't give them the jobs, but you're going to give it to the migrants? What's up with that? And so, as far as I'm concerned, it's time to take down Angela Merkel.
Yeah.
It's time to knock down Germany in this.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously for the young people, this is a major, major problem, Susan, you've hit on here, particularly the youngsters. We've got a brewing all sorts of kind of potential for street fighting between the right, far right and the left.
Everybody, we're coming to the break. This is the COVID Report with Susan Lindauer. Right back.
Uncensored talk and news you won't hear in the mainstream media. 24 hours a day. Truth Frequency Radio. We are TFR. Your protection from deception.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the COVID Report with Susan Lindauer. My great guest today, Tony Gosling and Franz Scott, talking about the European Union. I really am so glad that we're having this conversation because here in America, I'll tell you what's happening. They're talking about the British vote to pull out of the European Union, the referendum, which is coming in just a few weeks. They're talking about it as a source of collapse for the American economy, that the breakup of the European Union, that Britain pulling out of the European Union would spell disaster and doom and gloom and chaos and the Eurozone would disintegrate, and then we're going to have a global depression sort of thing, that this could be a trigger for a global depression. But really, it is, and I think that you have dispelled that for me, at least. You've persuaded me that this just has got to change. The situation cannot stand the way that it is, and it's really a brave move to break this thing up, and or at least to pull Britain out of it. Not that it would, and that Britain pulling out of it would not break up the whole European Union at all, but it would save Britain from going down the ship.
Well, yeah, look, I mean, it's like I said before, slow strangulation. Which do you prefer? You know, are you going to actually face the music and face the economic realities of this kind of cliff edge situation we're on?
Well,
or are we going
to
carry on slowly?
Well, but hold on. It's even more than that, because it's the leadership of Britain, the elected representatives of the British people, taking back control, sovereignty of the country. And you guys have acceded less authority to the European Union than the others. But even Maggie Thatcher opposed this thing and refused to give up her power to the banksters. And she saved half of the problem is not even there, like compared to what France or Italy or Spain are suffering. But you guys, if you don't stand on your own, you can't save yourself when the hard times really hit, which are coming soon.
Well, you know, the United States of Europe, United States of America, it's the same thing, effectively, as a political federation. The idea that we're all kind of getting together on points of common interest, but whether we're retaining our independence. Well, of course, that hasn't happened in the states in America, in your individual states. They haven't really got proper independence. You know, big things like the Treasury, the FBI, the Federal Reserve are running things from central points, you know, like Washington, etc. So the same exact thing has happened in the United States of Europe. And, you know, I'm really glad, Susan, we're seeing people talking about the United States of Europe more and more over the last few weeks here in Britain, because that is exactly what it is. It's a kind of, actually, it's far less democratic than the US, and we know how little and how powerful the lobbies are in Washington and how little power ordinary people have. I mean, for example, how many millions of pounds is it you need in order to stand for a US president? I'm not sure.
Oh, hundreds of millions.
Well,
hundreds,
I mean,
of millions.
This is not democracy. This is the kind of Roman Republic version of democracy where, you know, back in the days of the Roman Empire, you know, where they had this kind of pretend democracy where we're trying to make out like this is somehow in working for the people, where actually it's really just working for us, and it's us managing the people, almost like sort of farmers managing the sheep and the goats and the pigs in the farm, you know. That's actually the reality of it nowadays. And I actually go back, I think, a lot. I mean, I don't know about you, but to George Orwell and his writings, where he's talking, you know, when he wrote Animal Farm, he obviously wrote 1984. I mean, back at the end of the Second World War, he'd been working for the BBC World Service during the war, doing propaganda in beaming that into India. And when he resigned from the BBC in 1943, I think it was, he said, well, actually, look, the propaganda isn't working anymore. And anyway, I've got no beef with you BBC guys who are employing me, but what I do think is that what we're doing is I'm wasting my time here, and I don't want to be wasting your time and my time. And I think we're coming to a similar phase here in Britain with the propaganda not working anymore. We've had recently,
amen, hallelujah.
Well, I hope so. I mean, here's the evidence, right? We had a big local elections here a couple of weeks ago for the mayor of London, for example. Well, I say local elections. I mean, you know, 10 million people electing. You know, it's a big area, London, to have a mayor. And there was a very vehement campaign by the Conservative, Jack Goldsmith, from a very wealthy background, very wealthy elite family, against Sadiq Khan, who is a Muslim, and he's standing as the Labour candidate for mayor. With all sorts of accusations of anti-Semitism against Khan, against various people within the Labour Party in the run-up to that vote. And even, for example, accusing Sadiq Khan of sharing a platform with the mastermind of the 7/7 bombers and all this kind of thing. It was actually pretty scary stuff for Londoners. Well, you know what? They said no thank you to Jack Goldsmith, and they voted for Sadiq Khan anyway. And so what's happened is that Well, yeah, and what's happened is this propaganda campaign in the month before the election for the mayor of London totally backfired on them. And so they've now got the first Muslim mayor in Europe is now mayor of London of 10 million people. So, you know, you've got a completely reverse kind of situation going on the ground. Of course, young people don't trust the media. They don't trust the propaganda. They're getting their stuff from the social media sources. And now we've got another vote coming up, which is this Brexit vote in a couple of weeks' time. But just before that, do you know what's happening, Susan? Well, it's the Bilderberg Conference.
Oh!
In Germany. In Germany. And I've booked my tickets because I think this is going to be one of the most interesting Bilderberg conferences ever. You know, basically what's been happening over the last few years, Bilderberg, I mean, for those of your listeners that aren't familiar with it, it effectively...
Oh, our listeners love hearing dishing on Bilderberg.
I've done a lot of work on this over the years, having been the first person to put the lists of who goes to these meetings on the internet back in 1995, and then have my web service provider close my website down saying, there's too many people reading it. It looks like there's an attack on your website. And then I saying no, it's just people are interested, you know, so they put it back up again. Is that these conferences were started back in 19 54 under the chairmanship of Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who he was German aristocracy. He'd been in the SS, he'd been in the Nazi party before he'd even been in the SS, and yet he tried to deny that. And then he married into the Dutch royal family just before the war. And many people now say that he was actually a Nazi agent in the middle of the British establishment. He was sent over to Canada for a while, but he was involved in the liberation of Holland in World War II. And there he is. You can see pictures of him peeping over General Montgomery's shoulder.
So he played both sides, is what he tried to say.
So,
at the end, tried to say that he played both sides. But so anyway, so he was one of the founding members of the Bilderberg.
That's right. People have often asked me, well, why they call it the Bilderberg Conference? Well, this is the Bilderberg Hotel in this little town called Oosterbeek on the outskirts of Arnhem in Holland, where the first meeting took place, which Bernhard was presiding over, and he ran it for the first 20 years up until 1975 in the Lockheed scandal when he was booted out. But the reason it started there, Susan, is pretty sinister. It was the location 10 years previously to the first Bilderberg meeting of this attempt to liberate Holland by the Allies, Operation Market Garden. It's made famous by the film A Bridge Too Far. And what had happened was effectively the British had been sabotaged from their own side. Bernhard had leaked the information about this so-called surprise airborne landing to the Nazis before the operation took place. So, of course, you know, there was no actual element of surprise. The Nazis had built up extra flak positions to shoot down the planes as they brought the paratroopers in. For example, there's also very strong evidence that they'd brought a SS Panzer Corps in to rest just in the nearby area. So, of course, then suddenly these almost really lightly armed paratroopers had to cope with tanks and SS Panzer Division just in the area. And so the 1st Airborne Division were isolated in Arnhem in this place called the Witch's Cauldron on the outskirts of Arnhem. And for 3 or 4 days, these poor paratroopers were absolutely mangled by the Hitler's armies, using flamethrowers, using rockets, using tanks against lightly armed paratroopers. So that area at the end of an Operation Market Garden, which ultimately was a failure in its attempt to cross the Rhine and get a bridgehead over the Rhine, that area was called the Hexenkessel, the Witch's Cauldron, where the British troops were massacred. And you know what? 10 years later, in exactly the same spot, that's where the very first Bilderberg meeting took place, in the Bilderberg Hotel in Oosterbeek, in the same area. And, you know, I think what's going on there is two things. One is a kind of in-joke amongst the Nazis saying, well, look, this is where we massacred the Brits in the Witch's Cauldron a few years ago, and we had prior knowledge through our spies that this operation was going to take place by Montgomery. But the other thing, I think, is that you've got a whole history really around the Dutch, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands and others. So, I mean, that's why I think that operation took place where it did, you know, or the Bilderberg meeting started where they did, is that kind of horrific kind of in joke amongst Nazis saying, well, look, this is our little club. And of course, Prince Bernhard, having been in the SS, was the perfect person to start it in 1954.
So it was like an inside joke for the Nazis.
Yeah, it's just a little in joke.
And the German bankers who are then fulfilling their destiny through a different means of German domination over the European continent and European economy, which is exactly what they've done very effectively.
Exactly. I mean, Deutsche Bank, of course, very, very powerful still. But look, the other thing about that particular operation and why the Nazis loved it so much, the massacre and the failure of Operation Market Garden, was because it gave them an extra 5 months. Now, most analysts will tell you that if they gained that bridgehead over the Rhine at the time, it would have caused absolute havoc amongst the German supply lines on the Western Front. It would have given them a route into the Ruhr, the Allied troops into the manufacturing areas. They would have gone round the German defences, the West Wall, and so it actually extended the war by 5 months. This was absolutely crucial for the Nazis and their collaborators amongst the Allies, because it enabled
it enabled them to squirrel away all that wealth around the world, to taking it to places like South America, to Switzerland, and to plan for the recrudescence of the Nazi empire after World War II. Because, I mean, you know, this is, seems to be one of those great unanswered questions of world history that's still never been properly addressed, is what happened to that $1 billion or so of wealth that was looted from the whole of Europe? Anyone that was ever involved in World War II will tell you, in occupied Europe, one of the first things that the Nazis did when they occupied was that they commandeered all valuables. They went through every single building, taking anything that was valuable, and that all went back to Berlin. So where did that all go? Well, the answer is probably most of it to Switzerland, because it's very convenient, and the Swiss made a lot of money out of World War II. But that was what was used, I think, to build this kind of wicked financial empire that we've seen since World War II. And Paul Manning's book spells it out absolutely, line by line. 750 corporations were created by Bormann over in South America, and this looted wealth of World War II was laundered around the world, a lot of it through Sullivan and Cromwell law firm, which was the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York, and then put into these new companies that Bormann had created. And the directors of those companies, well, most of them were simply former SS people who'd taken off their uniforms at the end of the war and just put on nice clean-cut suits and marched into the boardrooms. And in fact, interesting, this Panama Papers thing that's been recently, that firm was set up by a former SS soldier, by a former Nazi soldier originally, and it looks to me as if this is simply one of those companies that was set up quite possibly to launder Nazi money, and it was then after that used as a kind of conduit for people who wanted to avoid paying tax in their own home countries.
Wow, you are such a wealth of knowledge. Tony, I'm so impressed. I'm just sitting here. This is a history lesson.
It is. I think we all should be doing these history lessons, because unless you understand, I think the origins of the Bilderbergs particularly, you know, is an important one, because, look, these people control most of the money in the Western world. And unless we understand that, you know, I don't think there's unless you're being taught that, you're being taught a very partial view of history. And with this Bilderberg meeting, by the way, it's happening in Dresden between, I think it's the 9th and the 12th of June, which is just literally 2 weeks before Britain votes.
Well, now, hold on, there's going to be something. Oh, wait a minute. 2 weeks before Britain votes? When does Britain vote?
I think it's the 23rd or 25th of June. I'm not sure the exact date.
Well,
but anyway,
hold on. The June 9th through the 12th, that's significant because, from America's standpoint, because the California primaries in the presidential elections are on June 7th. And so June 9th through 12th, by this point, they're going to know exactly who is the Democrat nominee for the White House, and they will probably be, among other topics, this is going to be a big one. This is going to be a big, important
thing.
Because they're also going to be deciding, they're looking at the European Union, and they're also going to be looking at who's running the United States. And they're going to be trying to figure out how to get their candidate into power. And the fact is that the people, the American people, the populist vote is so rabidly furious against the establishment, we are in full revolt right over here.
Well, look, the Bilderberg have already promised the Democratic nomination to Hillary. I don't know if you know that. This was about 10 years ago, actually, when Obama first stood. Hillary really wanted to stand, and she was summoned to a Bilderberg conference. I think it was at Chantilly in Virginia, and in no uncertain terms told to hold her fire and that she would get her chance once Obama had his. And so she will be, I think, very annoyed if she doesn't get the nomination. And she might even start spilling the beans about Bilderberg to a certain extent. Who knows? Although, I doubt it. I think the other thing, of course, is Hillary is now implicated by Seymour Hersh in and signing off the supply of sarin gas through Benghazi to the Syrian rebels, which was then used in the so-called you've crossed the line attack, you know, the sarin gas attack three years ago? Crikey,
well,
three years.
But you know, but I'll tell you something. Her work in Libya, Syria, Ukraine. The people, the American people are horrified. And again, they're running into, we've got like 10 minutes left in the show, and I don't want to turn to Hillary so much, but maybe a little bit, but not, the point is here, the last 10 minutes of the show, we have the people. And this is a very important Bilderberg meeting because the European Union is the bankers against the people, and the presidential campaigns are the banksters against the people. And we are not passive. We are fighting back. We're furiously angry. We are going into full revolution mode. And I truly believe that the Bilderberg, I know you guys all think it's a great agenda and it's a great plan, but they have lost control of their agenda. They may have, more power than we do, but we've got more numbers than they've got, and they cannot control us. And social media, and that's why we have all these troubles with Skype. I am convinced that Google and Skype and Microsoft own Skype, for example, and they're making as much headaches as they can. They're trying to burrow in, but they can't stop us from speaking and connecting with each other.
Well, no, they can't. But the thing is that they could do a certain amount of tweaking of that, I suppose. But they can't ever stop the actual flow of information, I don't think. Not completely, not yet. Now, of course, one of the things is that they've moved everything from trusted, reliable, journalistic, professional. I mean, this is what we used to have here in Britain, it's fair to say. In the 1980s and even into the early 1990s, we had a very good professional journalism standards here in Britain, where you would always get pretty much both sides of a discussion and argument. So they've driven that more fair and honest debate onto the digital platforms. Those digital platforms are actually far, far easier to control than the old-fashioned mainstream media used to be. I mean, I'm not really familiar with the situation in the US, but we had a very, very good media here in the 1970s, 80s, and early 90s. And that, by driving it onto digital platforms, of course, for them it makes it much easier to manage. And who is it that's just stepped up to take membership of the Bilderberg Steering Committee at Christmas? I mean, they say they only have one meeting a year, but they obviously don't. They had a meeting just before Christmas where they appointed new people to join the Bilderberg Steering Committee alongside Henry Kissinger and the rest, and David Rockefeller and the others. And that is Eric Schmidt from Google. He's now on the steering committee. The other person who's joined is John Saws, who's the former head of MI6, who was discredited here in Britain after his agents and officers radicalized some guy who was basically a totally peaceful, peace-loving Muslim and turned him into this maniac, Jihadi John. He was kicked out of his job at MI6, but then all of a sudden walked straight into one of the top posts at the Bilderberg Steering Committee. So you can see the pattern here is that you've got former crooked intelligence chiefs sitting down with the head of Google, YouTube, whatever, Mr. Schmidt himself, at the top of this organization now, Susan. Very, very few people have recognized this around the world. Very few journalists have recognized that there's these subtle, quiet changes at the top of the building.
Oh, it's very important. Yes.
And these are the people that, I mean, I've been to several of these meetings. Obviously,
Google is now part of Bilderberg. Very disturbing.
Well, not just part of it, on the steering committee. So these are the people that make the decisions about where the meeting's going to take place, what's going to be on the agenda, who's going to get invited, who isn't going to get invited. I mean, they're the conduit between, I suppose, the NATO political lobby and the military industrial complex, really. I mean, so they are absolutely live, what bunch of wires, and the banksters as well, of course, because that's where you'll get all of the various chancellors, people who are in charge of our money that we have to pay in tax or we go to jail. These are the people that get their instructions at the Bilderberg conferences, and with Eric Schmidt sitting around the committee that decides who comes and who doesn't. This is rather worrying for the future of any of these online platforms, which many people argue anyway. Actually, most of things like Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google get much of their cash from the NSA and from these big intelligence services, quid pro quo deals. health, because we are taking all their services for free, for granted. Their loyalty as businesses is much more to the people who are paying them behind the scenes, people like the NSA, as Edward Snowden revealed, than they are to us.
Well, you know, that's very important. That's very important, Tony. We have just a few minutes left. How does the people power impact this? Because, again, there's only a few of them. There are hundreds of millions, billions of us. So our power is revolutionary power.
But look, we can only, you know, mobilize that, I think, when people are aware of what's going on. And I'm really glad to see, I mean, I chat a lot to younger people, and I'm always quizzing them about what they think about this and that. And you know what? I've got total faith in the young generation. Okay, so as ever, some of them don't care. They're only interested in girls and football and Coca-Cola. But there's a fantastic number of youngsters now who are incredibly switched on to what's going on in the world. The great fraud of the war on terror, for them, this is what they see on their nightly news is nothing more than a joke. They think it's absolute nonsense, and they laugh in the face of these idiotic newscasters. And whatever these elites decide that they want to try and do with us, you can be absolutely sure there's going to be an enormous backlash, because not the sorts of policies that the British Empire and that the IMF have been carrying out in other parts of the world, in Africa, these hideous kinds of treatment of the various colonial countries. What's starting to happen is Western elites are now turning those same exact policies, like structural adjustment, on their own people in Europe, in the domestic situation. And this, I think, is going to be their biggest mistake they've ever made, Susan, because those people are largely well-educated, highly intelligent, have got good, basically decent spiritual moral values, most of them, and they're not fooled by this Coca-Cola culture, most people. And so
the Coca-Cola culture is about to collapse. Consumerism is about to go, and we're going to have to fall back on our moral values in order to help each other build up our communities and pull each other through this. And this centralism will not work. It's going to have to be local power in order to survive.
I point to this vote for the London mayor is the most brilliant sign, I think, that's been sent out. And in fact, much of the London media has gone completely silent about it, Susan. For example, in Bristol, you know, which for many years was Britain's second city, it isn't anymore. We also kicked out a merchant venture, a slave trading mayor from the Society of Merchant Venturers in Bristol, which still exists. These were the slave traders. These were the same families that financed Cabot's trip to so-called Discover America, that I think might have been discovered by Native Americans a little bit before that, but you know, began the colonization process from Bristol. This guy was George Ferguson, ex-merchant venturer. He was running Bristol as a sort of secret conservative, because the conservative would never get elected in Bristol. And then those same local elections I was talking about, we've now got a black mayor, Marvin Rees. This, again, was not really promulgated through any of the media. What's happening is there is this revolution is actually finding its way through the political process, slowly but surely, although the London media don't want to talk about it.
Listen, everybody, we're about to go out. The future depends on the younger people. That we are the people. We own the future. The older people are exiting the stage, and the young people have totally different perspectives. That's where the future lies. And it is not going to stay the way it is, because inevitably they are not going to let it happen. Thank heavens for that. We will be back next week, everybody. Thank you, Tony and Fran, for joining me today.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you, Susan. Take care.